Morning. So I'm going to start off with a poem from Pablo Neruda. And it was at that age poetry arrived in search of me. I don't know. I don't know where it came from winter or a river. I don't know how or when. No, they were not voices. They were not words nor silence. But from a street I was summoned, from the branches of night, abruptly from the others, among violent fires, or returning alone. There I was, without a face, and it touched me. So my friend Jay, years ago, was practicing Zen meditation in the Midwest. She had the chance to go to San Francisco to attend a retreat, a session, probably about a five-day session, with my teacher, my first teacher, Suzuki Roshi. And on about something like the third day or the fourth day of the retreat, after the meditation bell went off to end the meditation, she got up, and he got up not too far away from her, I guess. I don't know. And she just looked at him, and she said when she looked in his eyes, she just saw indescribable spaciousness. Indescribable spaciousness. And so on her way home on the airplane, she still felt that. And when her own dialogue, when her own talking to herself started coming back, she would say to herself, no dependence on words and letters. And then it would come back. The indescribable spaciousness just came back. Because he'd been talking about Bodhidharma's statement, no dependence on words and letters. So that catalyzed her, that phrase, just to come back to just being, to just stillness. So I thought of that when I read Pablo Neruda's poem. In a way, she was summoned from a street, from Chicago. That's a big street, right? Summoned from Chicago. And she didn't know where it came from, where the spaciousness. She had no idea. She was summoned to pass through a gate to a still point where all possibilities exist. All possibilities. Or we could say no possibilities exist. It doesn't matter exactly the same, you know. So that's our practice. Our practice is to release ourselves from the momentum of the past. The past has built much momentum that it just impinges on us continually. But we have the possibility to just pass through the gate so that we're no longer caught by that. Maizumi Roshi said, once through the gate, the discovery is made that the gate is not actually a barrier or an opening through which to pass. It's simply reality presenting itself. So every breath, every touch, every taste. And that's our intention in Zen practice. Our intention, my intention, to continually return to the state, to enter the state in which we surrender our path. We talk a lot about the Buddhist path, but we surrender it. We surrender our direction. And if we listen carefully, we're continually being summoned
from the street, from the hurly-burly, chaotic life of the street. We're continually being summoned to this.
We're being summoned even if we don't listen. Because it's our nature. It's our true nature. Summoned from where we thought we were heading, from what we thought we were doing. Suddenly, your face is missing. Her face was missing. Your identity can't be found. And something huge touches us, which isn't even huge, touches us. And this all sounds cool, but to ambiguity is really not that easy and not that attractive. You actually have to do it. It's very ironic that it's so cool and wonderful, and yet when it actually comes down to it, we don't like it, we don't want it, we don't want to go there. It's interesting, isn't it? It's interesting. So, as many of you guys know, I've given my notice that I'm stepping down from Guider in a year from now. Oh, sure. Thank you. So, this should not be a big deal, right? But I'm very attached to my role here. Very attached to my place. So it's time for me to practice what I've been preaching. Well, I don't want to practice it. I don't want to. So it's a human condition, right? You will never transcend that. But you always have a chance to come back to total openness. I always have a chance to come back to total stillness. So now I'm going to read this story. This is a long story. I don't think I've read this story before. I might have. Long story about Padachara and Buddha. Okay, so Padachara, who lived in India at the time of the Buddha, was a very strong young woman. When her parents picked out a prospective husband for her, she secretly married instead a servant who had long been her lover. If I haven't talked about this before, someone else has. She was, from the beginning, not much of a rule follower. The consequence of that allegiance to her own heart was rejection by her family. She and her husband had to leave and make their home in a distant part of India. It was the custom in that culture for a woman to return to her mother's house when it was time to give birth. When her first child was due, Padachara was delayed by her husband in starting her journey and gave birth in the woods. When she was pregnant the second time, her husband was again resistant, so she began the trek without him. He soon followed and found his family deep in the woods as a fierce storm began kicking up. As he gathered wood to build a shelter for his child and pregnant wife, he was bitten by a snake and quickly died. Padachara gave birth alone. She sheltered her newborn and her other child with her body as the storm raged on. In grief over her husband's unexpected death, she also realized that she and her children would no longer be welcome in his village. Her only option was to proceed to her parents' home and beg to be welcomed. To get there, she had to cross a large river, now a torrent because of the storm. Unable to make the crossing with both children, she told the toddler to stay put and entered the water carrying the newborn. She crossed the river, settled the newborn into a nest of leaves, and began to make her way back for her other child. But when she reached mid-river, to her horror, she saw a hawk swoop down, pick up the baby, and begin carrying it away as prey. She cried out, trying to get the hawk to release it, but it ignored her. Her older child, hearing her shriek, thought she was calling him to come to her. He ran into the water toward her, and she watched. Oh, you guys can come on in. Come on in. Come on in. Her older child, hearing her shriek, thought she was calling him to come to her. He ran into the water toward her, and she watched as he was swept away up in the waves and drowned. Potiphar brought to a level of sadness was brought to a level of sadness so low it's hard to imagine. Somehow she made her way out of the river and continued walking toward her old home. Along the road, she met someone from the town and asked them about her family. The person told her that during the storm, her family's house collapsed and they were killed. She went mad with grief and no longer tried to protect herself. She wandered naked, disheveled, disoriented. So she lived according to her heart, and she persevered against all odds. And then she exhausted in her great suffering all her reference systems. All her paths, all her ways of being in the world, totally exhausted. So she's naked. She's naked. She's let go of everything. So here, the story continues. Unwilling to organize herself to fit into her culture, she kept wandering. When she came upon the Jetta Grove where the Buddha was teaching, his disciples found her frightening and appalling. But when the Buddha saw her, he rose and followed her. He placed himself in her path, and when they met, said, "Sister, it is time to recover your presence of mind." Potiphar came to her senses, realized she was naked, and gratefully covered herself with a cloak. Then she asked Buddha to help her. She heard not simply the words of Shakyamuni Buddha, but the timeless Buddha voice which calls us to wake up. And she had emptied herself of games and illusions so completely that she could hear it. After listening to Potiphar's tragic story, the Buddha told her that throughout many lives she had shed more tears for the loss of loved ones than there was water in the oceans. So this voice, which is not a voice, meets us in our suffering. When we drop all the devices that we've created to try to be someone different than what we are already, than what is already. This I, which is a Buddha I and not an I at all, meets us in our suffering. When we drop all of our devices, all of our strategies, all of our ideas, all of our paths to become something different than what we all are already, than what is already. Then the Buddha reminded her that at your death, even had they all been living, your family could only look on in helpless despair. Only the Dharma can help you. Hearing this, Potiphar decided to ordain and was taken into the nuns' community, which welcomed her. So Buddha told her, recover your presence of mind, and then he ordained her. Ordained her. This is really about being ordained into the truth of what is, which is boundless, which is boundless. And nobody can help us do this. Nobody can help us do this. But we can open ourselves up to that possibility moment to moment, to something we hear or something we see. It startles us into just being completely present. So supposedly Padacharya went on to become a great teacher. She had 30 disciples, which for a woman of her time was very odd. Very odd. Her enlightenment poem, which gives us an indication of what she realized, says, "Bathing my feet, I watched the bath water spill down the slope. I concentrated my mind the way you train a good horse. Then I took a lamp and went into my cell, checked the bed and sat down on it. I took a needle and pushed the wick down. As the lamp went out, my mind was freed." Pablo Neruda says, "Then I was without a face, and it touched me." And Jane Hirschfield writes, "That face becomes birds singing and deer, fish, and mosquitoes emerging to feed at dawn and at dusk." And Padacharya says, "I concentrated my mind the way you train a good horse." That's really our practice, isn't it? We're concentrating our mind moment after moment in our zazen, the way we train a good horse. We think we have a bad horse, but you've got a good horse. There aren't any bad horses. Just needs a little training, that's all. A little TLC and a little training. A lot of TLC and a lot of training. More TLC and more training than you want. I know that, but that's the way it is. That's the way it is. It's a good horse. It's a very good horse. Each of your horses, the best horse. Each of your horses are the very best horse. So we're having a practice period going on now, which about 25 people are doing. And this just means that folks commit themselves to a daily sitting practice and then meet once a week to support each other and hear a talk from me or Bonnie. And they're making the commitment, aren't they, to train a good horse, to concentrate their mind and train a good horse. That's what Zen practice is about. And of course, that horse is going to wander off a lot, going to fly off a lot, right? And that's just part of the whole situation. That's just part of the whole deal. I talked a year ago about my grandson Logan, my second grandson, learning how to walk. And what is learning how to walk? What is it? Falling down and getting up and falling down and getting up. Watch a two-year-old. Watch a one-and-a-half-year-old. What is learning how to walk? The horse wanders off. You bring it back. You fall down. You get up. My older grandson, Ethan, wasn't into this falling down and getting up thing. So he stayed crawling for a whole 9 months longer because he knew it wasn't going to be easy, right? Who wants to do it? Who wants to do it? Who wants to do this stupid Zen practice with this bad horse that we've got that won't behave? Which is really the best horse. How could you have a better horse? How could you? Very lucky. Each of you is very lucky. And I'm very lucky, too, to be with you. Very lucky. And at some point, we fall into total self-forgetfulness. We just fall into it. Well, here's my teacher, Suzuki Roshi. I think this is in Zen Mind Beginner's Mind, probably. "In this limitless world, our throat is like a swinging door. The air comes in and goes out, like someone passing through a swinging door. If you think I breathe, the I is extra. There is no you to say I. What we call I is just a swinging door, which moves when we inhale and when we exhale. It just moves, that is all. When your mind is pure and calm enough to follow this movement, there is nothing. No I, no world, no mind, no body, just a swinging door.
So we've been summoned from the street. We've been summoned to the street to live our lives as a swinging door. It's enough just to practice this now. That's plenty just to practice this now. On each now, just to practice it. Just to practice it.
And you guys, too, may have also cried more tears than there is water in the ocean.
You may have. You may have. You may have. Because life is scary. No wonder Ethan didn't want to, he wanted to crawl for an extra year.
I want to crawl for an extra year, an extra 5 years, an extra 10 years.
Who doesn't? Who doesn't? Life is fearful, and there's a lot of suffering all over the place. And it's time for us to recover our presence of mind. Simple. Simple. This time. Not another time. This time. This is the time to recover it. To uncover it.
That bad horse, which is the best horse. Uncover it. So I went to visit my friend Don, who turned, he's about 91, I guess, or 92. He's a former CFO of a big corporation, and he's a donor to my agency, and he's become my friend over the years. I went to visit him maybe about 10 years ago in this assisted living home that he's living in north of St. Paul. And since he has money, it's a very beautiful home. Very beautiful. And Don's situation is that his wife went blind 2 years ago, and he took care of her, tried to take care of her. And then she died. And the year before that, he has 4 sons, but one of them committed suicide. And the reason I went to see him was he didn't show up at our, we have an advisory council. He didn't show up at our advisory council, and he always shows up. So I went to visit him, and I knew he was having a hard time because, geez, who wouldn't given that situation? And he said, well, you know, I lost my driver's license. I couldn't come because I lost my driver's license. He said, I made the mistake of thinking I should take the test. I don't have to take the test. I made the mistake of thinking I should take the driving test to show everybody. Well, I showed myself I couldn't pass it. So there he was in that home. There he is. His wife's gone. I visited him there with his wife for a long time. He says his sons come to visit him once a week. And there's a feeling that I have in the whole place, even though it's beautiful. You know, it's a beautiful place. But everybody's seems to be in the same situation as him in that place. It's misery. It's old age, sickness, and death. I mean, that's what it is. You can make the home as beautiful as you want. You can have great gardens and fountains as they do. It's misery. It's old age, sickness, and death. Well, it's the situation, the human situation, which we're all moving towards, like it or not. Like it or not. And so Don invites me to have lunch with him in a little luncheonette, right? We have lunch together. And he's bent and he's shuffling. And we go. And I ask him, you know, when he had a relative visit last, and it was a week ago. But, you know, he stays in a kind of attention, a kind of attentiveness, a kind of presence of mind that deeply moves me, deeply moves me. I want to talk to him about, oh, how hard it is. And he said, well, should we go for a walk? Well, look at the flowers. let's stop and look at the sky. And he can barely walk, but we look at the sky together. Where did he get that? Where did he get that? He didn't even practice Zen. You don't have to practice Zen to come back to this being that's here, regardless of old age, sickness, and death, regardless of suffering, this clarity, this stillness, that attentiveness, that's your birthright. It's more your birthright than anything is. Everything else is made up, fabricated. This is not fabricated. Nobody fabricated it. That's why it's so still, you guys. So their Don is courteous, gentle, noble, and accepting. And he helps me come back to the swinging door. How can I be pissing and moaning when Don can just be there? I can be there too, can't I? You can be there too, here too, can't you? We can. Doesn't matter. Doesn't matter. And the swinging door is rather delightful if we just go with it. Rather delightful. So in Zen practice, in formal Zen, we have two kinds of initiation into a lifetime of swinging door practice. Two kinds of initiation. One is what we call, they call it lay ordination or jukai. I just call it initiation. And that's where you sew one of these raksus. And then we have a second type of initiation, which is priest ordination, where you sew a big robe. And in both of these ceremonies, which we do in Zen and have done for hundreds of years, the focus is on removing the identity and status that we cling to, removing that, so that we commit ourselves to just living like a swinging door, as a swinging door. And in the priest ordination ceremony, not only do we do this figuratively, but historically, they gave up their names, they gave up their hair, they gave up their conventional clothes, and they wore this robe that was made out of rags from the funeral pyres that they sewed together. So it was quite literal. It was not only symbolic, quite literal. Padachara, as I read the story, what did she do? She shed her clothes. She shed her social protection. She didn't want to shed it. She did, though. She shed it. Her social appropriateness was totally gone. Totally gone. And then she was ordained. And she was ordained. So we are having an ordination ceremony here, a priest ordination ceremony of Stacy, which is coming up on November 3rd. And if you'd like to be part of it, please do. Please do. But ceremony or no ceremony, the only home for ego, if you do this practice, is swinging door. That's the only home. Whether you go through initiation or not, we're committing ourselves to practice, even if it's only 10 minutes a day of sitting. Just 10 minutes a day of removing ourselves from that street that we spend our lives hanging out on, haggling and worrying and fighting and moaning. And embracing something unknowable. Just embracing it. Just embracing it. The desert fathers entered the desert. The forest. Monks and nuns entered the forest. We're returning to the wilderness where there's no path. No path. So Buddha's words to Padacara were, recover your presence of mind. And she did. My teacher's glance, just a glance, he probably didn't even know he was doing it. He just glanced at my friend Jay from stillness, from emptiness. He just glanced. He didn't know anything. And what happened? She also recovered her presence of mind. She fell also into a great stillness, which stayed with her almost the whole plane ride home. Darn, darn. Oh, we want her back, don't we? We want her back so much. Or at least I get it if we haven't had it, got her back. But it only happens when we release. It only happens when we allow ourselves to fall into self-forgetfulness. Her enlightenment poem again. Bathing my feet, I watched the bathwater spill down the slope. I concentrated my mind the way you train a good horse. This is the whole thing. This is all. Or you never need to study any Buddhism. You never need to do any initiation. You never need to da-da-da-da. You concentrate your mind the way you train a good horse. Then I took a lamp and went into my cell, checked the bed, and sat down on it. I took a needle and pushed the wick down. As the lamp went out, my mind was freed. Very simple. Very simple. I'm going to read Pablo Neruda's poem again. And we'll see if I have anything more to say, or maybe you guys will have something to say. And it was at that age, poetry arrived in search of me. I don't know. I don't know where it came from winter or a river. I don't know how or when. No, they were not voices. They were not words, nor silence. But from a street I was summoned, from the branches of night, abruptly from the others, among violent fires or returning alone. There I was, without a face, and it touched me. So, we could have a little conversation. Would you like to have a little conversation? We could have some questions or stories or songs. Yeah.
The violent fires.
Yeah.
Well,
let's read this again. But from a street I was summoned, from the branches of night, abruptly from the others, among violent fires or returning alone. Well, there's a lot of violence in our lives. It appears that there's not violence. Underneath, there's violence. We want to turn off the television and not watch all that violence, partly because it reminds us of what's going on inside. So he was summoned from that violence. He was summoned by his Buddha mind, by his no mind. Summoned from it to just practice, to just return to his original stillness. And that violence is still going on, but we're summoned. We're summoned. And regardless of how still everybody acts or polite they are, underneath there's that fomenting going on for all human beings who were summoned from it. To a great, great spaciousness. Does that make sense? Do you believe me? Do you believe me?
Yeah, see, he has to practice it. We practice it. We practice it. That's what we do. We practice training this horse that seems so out of control. We want to trade this horse in for another horse. Because of our mom and dad, we got a fucked up horse. Excuse me. We got a bad horse. A poor horse. We need it. But this is the best horse. This is the horse that's teaching us how to come back to just being. To just being.
I want to say something about that. The level you had, and I'm relating it specifically to society's unwillingness to recognize some kinds of suffering otherwise.
Oh. A letter in the paper this morning? Uh-huh. About society's unwillingness to recognize certain kinds of suffering?
You had a letter to the editor this morning.
Oh, was that letter published in the paper? Oh, cool. Cool. Oh, cool. Thank you. I'll have to go out and buy the paper. And what did I say?
You were talking about mental illness.
Yes, I was talking about mental illness. What I was talking about in this letter that I didn't think it had gotten published. I just forgotten about it. What I was talking about was, this guy who killed these people, his boss, and these people here in the Twin Cities, and he had a bipolar disorder. Well, what I was deeply moved by was that the Star Tribune had a front page picture of the parents of this guy, and a very sympathetic story about how they'd struggled, how they didn't know what to do, how they were doing their best, and how this was all kind of this was all confusing. And what I liked about the story was that there was so much compassion in it and so much empathy for the parents. And in the old days, that never would have happened. The whole family would have gotten dissed. The parents would have gotten dissed. Everybody would have been quiet about it. So, yeah, yeah. Well, thank you. Thank you for bringing that up. I'm going to buy paper on the way home. It takes courage. It takes courage. We have so many social constrictions. It takes one. In this case, it just took one reporter to saying, "Well, you know, I'm going to write about this. I'm going to show how heroic the parents are and how difficult the family is. I'm going to put it in the front page." Yeah, I thought it was cool. Yeah. Yeah, that's even better, isn't it? That's wonderful. That's wonderful. Yeah. Right in the middle of violent fire. Right in the middle of violent fire. There they are. There they are. Telling their story with straightforwardness, with showing that they did their best to train the horse. Sometimes we try to train the horse and the horse can't get trained. But when the horse can't get trained, it's already trained. It's already trained. Yeah.
I was so grateful that the Anipatachara story was not the, well, if you had listened to your parents and married the right guy in the first place, this would have happened to you.
So was I.
And instead, after all of that sadness, she was still able to find something precious in life and become part of it, even despite all of that.
Yeah. Yeah. Uh-huh. Uh-huh. Yeah, that's good, isn't it? That's good. That's good.
Uh-huh. You have told the story before.
Have I told it?
Yeah.
Did I read the whole thing?
I think so. I just remember it because it has really stayed with me. It really hit me. And the thing that my heart really turns to you within that enlightenment poem, but she washes her feet. She returns to the water. And so that's just a little bit of that river. She hasn't, you know, recovered her mind and covered it up and covered everything that has come before.
Oh, good. Good. Pardon?
Good thing you're ordaining her.
What?
Good thing you're ordaining her.
Oh, yeah. Anybody else?
This is the first time I've ever been here. New to Minneapolis. I guess about a month and a half. I made attempts at meditation before, things like that, and it's been a little tumultuous for me, but the timing of this was, today happened to work out. I've been listening to Eckhart Tolle again and starting to pay attention to walking around and paying attention to my legs as opposed to being all up into my head. I guess just a little note that's kind of neat to kind of discover you folks over here.
Well, thank you. Thank you. Need to discover you.
Sounds like a good idea.
Okay. All right.
The story affected me.
Well, I think there's nothing more. Laura, are you our person today?
Yes.
Okay.
So,